All right, Travers, it's a special episode tonight, 54, and we are joined by Darko. Hi, Darko.
Hello, friends. How are you doing? Thank you so much for having me on this Talking Clouds show.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for being here, and I'm going to let you introduce yourself here in a second, but the first thing I wanted to say is just I heard through the grapevine, aka your Discord channel, that you have just recently gotten a new gig within AWS. So I wanted to say congratulations on that. And then why don't you introduce yourself to everybody if they don't know who you are and tell us about your new role?
Of course, of course. Well, hello friends, my name is Darko. I go by what they call these days a developer advocate. Basically, I get to chat to developers, to engineers, to folks out there building and trying stuff on AWS. And my new role is titled Distinguished Developer Advocate. It sounds incredibly fancy. Mm-hmm. It's not as fancy as you think. Basically, in this new role, I've been kind of doing that for most of my career, but now especially is I want to make sure that folks building on AWS actually have the best experience they have. So instead of me just going to events and talking at people, I am going to spend a lot more time listening to people to make sure that AWS's voice and the stuff we build for developers is actually what you want us to do. So for that reason, I've even built a platform called pingdarko.com where people can go and just leave me anonymous messages. No chance that will ever fail.
Yeah, no.
So that's going to be interesting. I'm actually currently in the process of building even worse, a worse thing for that. I have a little receipt printer.
Yeah.
And anytime somebody sends me a message, a receipt should come out.
Oh, man.
It's gonna be fun, and just like in the middle of the night, just start spitting out receipts.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But I did put some throttling in there, so
that could hopefully be interesting. That you'll have physical proof of things that people say on the internet, which could never be wrong or bad.
Nope. Exactly. Yeah. But basically, that's my role. I want to make sure I talk to folks. And still heavily working with AWS, focusing on maybe a little bit more to our first-party community and first-party events, because I feel like I don't want us to lose the touch with developers there. So, yeah, stuff.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for joining. I think the other thing that would be interesting to learn a little bit more about you before we kind of get into the main topics is your sort of progression at AWS, because I think it's also a really great story, right? Because if I recall, you started as like enterprise support, right? Like 10-ish years ago or something.
Yes.
Like that? Yeah. So is there like, why don't you just kind of run us through that? I think that idea of sort of the career at AWS is also interesting for people to know about.
So first, let me get some AWS or Amazon terminology out of the way.
Okay.
So Amazon has a concept of levels. So when you join, there's like a specific job role level. And it starts from like one, it goes all the way up to, I think, 14 is the top one, like the Andy Jassy's 14 or something. Back in 2016, I joined as a level 4 premium support engineer. Actually joined in like the Windows pod, which means I was supporting customers using Windows on EC2. And I joined there, did some Windows, did some Linux, moved on to like what we used to call deployment services, which is your CloudFormations, your Elastic Beanstalks, and OpsWorks and whatnot. And then I slowly progressed from like being 2 years in premium support. I moved over to solution architecture. Basically, I got promoted to level 5 in support, and somebody decided, hey, listen, let's have Darko speak to customers directly face-to-face as a solution architect. So I spent a couple of years in Germany, in Berlin, actually, working as a solution architect. It was incredibly interesting to actually see what customers get to build. But this also provided me the opportunities to go and speak in front of multiple customers at like an event or like a customer internal hackathon where I would kind of teach AWS. And that opened the door for me. Hey, I can talk at people. I got a little promotion in solution architecture. I became a level 6 senior solution architect, which was really great. And the developer relations team back then, 2018, they realized, well, they were called technical evangelists back then. They were a little bit different. But they realized I can do stuff like that. And they started inviting me to events and go and speak on behalf of AWS. And in 2019, they offered me a job. Say, hey, you want to be a developer advocate? And I said, and I was like excited, gung-ho to go to all kinds of events in the world and speak and do conferences and just be a superstar on the road all the time on the airplanes and whatnot. Then something happened in 2020. I can't remember what.
Yeah.
We all decided to stay home.
Yes.
And then at home, I kind of built this thing where I would do like video content and live streams, and it's kind of how Brett, you and I met.
Yeah.
Did a bunch of content that way, and slowly progressed into more, let's say, serious developer advocate, where I started creating content and teaching others how to do content. And somehow in this whole thing, a promotion to level 7 came in to become a principal developer advocate. And I moved to the United States then from Germany. And then ever since then, I've been living in the Seattle Puget Sound area. And basically this week I got quote unquote promoted. I didn't change levels. I only changed titles to a distinguished developer advocate, because I get to do some fantastic stuff with amazing humans like Jeff Barr. So
yeah, that's awesome.
That's been the last 10 years, I guess,
in
this roller coaster of a ride.
It's a great origin story. I was chuckling as you said that, because in a previous life, I've always been a technical person, hands on keyboards. That's kind of, you know, I'll describe myself as a plumber, right? Like, you got to get from point A to point B. We need to connect a bunch of stuff to make that happen. I've always done that, always enjoyed it. And I started up my own consulting thing about 10 years ago, but that really came as a result of very similar to what you just described. I was working for a large partner at the time and was the technical guy. And my boss came to me one day and he's like, I want you to spend this summer going all over North America, and you're going to do customer events where it's going to be like an AWS boot camp. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. Like, I don't want to do that. And he's like, no, I think you do want to do that. And I'm like, I don't think I have much choice, right? He's like, no. So actually, it turned out to be a really fun summer. We got to see a lot of different places. It's very similar to you, like, talk to a lot of customers. And I came back and I was like, very similar to you. I was like, huh, I actually enjoy talking to people about this stuff, and just stumbled into a training job. So luckily for me, my old boss and I are still really good friends. I hold it over him. It's kind of like, well, it was your fault, man. Like, you made me do it. And then I decided to go do my own thing. So that's a really great origin story there. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Of course. And again, I come from a long line of what I used to call, what I call system administrators. Like, I used to build computers and do things and make sure that the stuff works, and massive systems from Windows to Linux to AIX to Solaris, right? But kind of when I moved to the cloud, the thing I've done has changed. And actually, weirdly enough, I've never was a software developer per se. Like, I've never written code for money, if that makes sense, right? I haven't built an application that sold, or I've been always kind of in the back end of things, but as I started using the cloud more and more and started doing stuff at AWS, especially as the role progressed, I started writing more and more code. And I still try to remain technical. I kind of code for fun and build stuff for fun. So even though my job is very much a marketing type job, I have a reputation to maintain. So it's
important. you gotta work on that still. Another thing that you just said there, the two things I just want to mention. Did you say AIX?
Did AIX, you say, yes. Our IBM AIX PowerPC servers. It was hilarious.
Oh, I did that. I worked for IBM Global Services and was an AIX administrator for a lot of years. Yeah. And I got to tell you another really funny story on this one. When I left IBM, I went and worked for another company, and they were using AIX for inventory systems, and they closed down. Mm-hmm. And my boss at the time, she was really great. She's like, I don't know what to do with all this stuff. Like, it's just going to go in the dumpster. And I'm like, huh, well, if I can take it, like, if I can get here and take it, could I take it? She's like, yeah, it's yours. If you want to take it, it'll be cheaper for you to take it than us. So I had a rack in my basement, and one of the machines was an AIX machine. I still have the storage for it, but I obviously didn't have a license to run it anymore. The best part of this story was when I tried to call IBM and get a license for AIX. And they're like, okay, well, like, what's your business name? I'm like, there is no business. The system just didn't know how to get me a license. So they finally, believe it or not, I got the right person on the phone, and they're like, so this is just running in your basement. Yeah, like, I'm a sysadmin. We'll just send you a copy. Don't worry about it. And I'm like, really? And I ended up with, do you remember back in the old days, IBM used to, like, they used to have like a stack of CDs that you could get with like all the different tools and stuff. And they literally sent me that with all the different AIX stuff. And I had an AIX server in my basement for years. I still have the storage. I don't have the server anymore. I don't know why I did that.
I was about to say, like, I don't know why you got rid of it, because I think I have a bunch of different things. I have Silicon Graphics, I have HP workstations, I have Spark systems and whatnot. I don't have an AX system. My only power PC stuff is my Mac stuff around here. But no AIX, no AIX, unfortunately.
You know, I regret it. It's funny that you mentioned that, because I want to talk to you about the vintage computing stuff, because I think that's also really cool. And I said to my wife, I'm like, yeah, I know I have that, and I wonder, and she's like, no, you got rid of that AIX server. And I'm like, really? I'm like, no, I wouldn't have done that, right? And she's like, no, I remember when you took that and donated it. And I was like, oh, that was dumb. Short-sighted, very short-sighted. But anyways,
it is a shame. It is a shame, but I get it. I mean, they're big power hunger systems. Like, I have a, there's behind me here, this is a Sun Ultra 60 workstation. Yeah. It's a dual CPU workstation, 450 megahertz. I think it's from the late 90s, early 2000s. And like, that thing on idle is like 600 watts just sitting there. So like, it's useless. Like, it's like, oh my God, let's not even try. Yeah. So, but it's still a great piece of technology. Yeah. I think I'm sad we got rid of all of those things, but I can talk about this all day long.
So. Oh yeah. It's awesome. So yeah, when you basically, what you're saying is, when you power that on, the lights in your house dim.
Yes, exactly.
It's a little power hunger.
Well, let me see if I can show this to you. I have a little off camera here. I have a system here, so I'm gonna try to do a little dance here with my camera. If I do this, change to my iPhone. Would this work?
Look at that.
Does this work? Does this not work?
We still see you.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if my there you go. Oh,
there it is.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
There you go.
So that thing there, that is a Data General S230 Eclipse mini computer.
That's crazy.
So it's a 1974 mini computer that used to be owned by NOAA, the North American Atmospheric Agency.
Oh wow,
the weather people.
Yeah.
And that thing basically uses two hard disks, which are underneath. You don't see them here, but there's two hard drives behind this table, and they are 76 megabyte hard drives, which when you turn them on, they draw 700 watts just spinning.
Oh my God.
And this whole computer, this whole rack requires a 60 amp circuit.
No,
oh my God. Okay.
So, yeah, I don't have anywhere to run it, right? That's not a thing I have in my house. But it's 120 volts, 60 amp requirements, and sure.
yeah. It's great to add to your collection, but you just get to look at it. You don't actually get to turn it on.
Exactly, and it's an interesting system, because it's a system. It doesn't have a CPU per se, right? It's a bunch of ALUs or arithmetic logical units. It doesn't use bytes. It uses words as a memory capacity. So it's 512 kilowords of memory.
Kilowords.
Which is, I think, kilowords. A word is like a double byte or something. It's I don't know. We don't use the word measurement anymore, but back then there was words. So I think it's around 1 megabyte of RAM.
Yeah.
I think, which again, for 1997, that was insane.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
That's awesome. So I guess the follow-up question to that is, like, how did you get started? Like, is it always just been an interest of yours? Like, how did you decide to start collecting vintage computers? Like, just interesting.
I think it mostly goes down to the fact... sorry, Travers.
I was going to say, why are these things in your house? Instead of a museum. Yeah.
Well, my answer to this is that I grew up in a third world country, and my primary computer was a Commodore 64 up until like 2001, right? The 2001, we had Windows XP then, and my only computer in my house was a Commodore 64. And I kind of like, and I didn't have anything for it. I had no games for it. I had nothing. I didn't have a floppy drive, because floppy drives were super expensive. So I only had a tape drive and a book and a lot of hard work. So I would basically write Commodore 64 games for myself so I could play them. And I couldn't always save them on tape, so I would write them, spend like a day or two writing it in BASIC and debugging it, and then I wouldn't turn off the computer for a couple of days because as soon as I turn it off, it's gone.
It was gone. You had to start again.
Oh my God.
It's gone. Yeah. Oh, so man. I have this incredible appreciation for old technology, just because I grew up with it. Even though I'm a child of the 90s and 2000s. I was born in 1988, so I'm not as old to kind of have lived these things, but I've kind of grew up with certain things, and I miss the whole 1990s period of computing and the 1980s period of computing, and I find it fascinating because, unlike today, today's computing is boring. There's not a lot of, like, it's all maybe one or two architectures. It's all kind of, everything looks and smells the same, which is great. That's how you commoditize computers. But back then, I mean, we mentioned, like, AIX and HP UX and Spark and 68K and 6502 and Z80 and a bunch of different architectures. Nothing was interoperable. Floppy disks weren't interoperable. Hard sector floppies weren't, it's a whole thing. Like, I have a floppy here. I'm going to show you. I have a look. Camera angles. Look at that. This is an 8-inch floppy disk for a Data General computer, for one of those that you've seen next to me.
Wow.
And this is a hard sectored floppy disk. So like, even if you had other computers where you can stick this in, it wouldn't work because it was made for this computer or for this drive. And that's it. You couldn't do anything more.
Wow. So, that's awesome.
Fan of that, and I started collecting it. And in Europe, it was harder to collect because they were a little bit more expensive, and especially where I come from, it wasn't that common. But when I moved to the States around 5 years ago, it was just like, oh my God, I can buy all of these things, and that's a problem. I just keep buying stuff.
Keep adding to your collection. You're gonna have to Travers' point. You're gonna have to have like a vintage computing museum at some point or something, where like other people that are really into this stuff can come and see that old machine.
Anybody who's my guest, I bring them in and show them the weirdest stuff I have here. So
that's awesome.
I sometimes just buy a computer that's broken and I fix it and I give it away. Because like I find joy in fixing these things, and they're simple enough that I can fix them.
Yeah.
Like I have a 1977 terminal sitting on that thing. It's a Heathkit H9 terminal, a dumb terminal.
Yeah.
But it's a glorious piece of equipment, and it was broken, didn't work, and I fixed it. Hey, great.
Cool.
I don't know what I'm going to do with it right now, so I'm probably going to give it away to somebody who wants it. So.
That's really cool. Well, I also cut my teeth on a Commodore 64. That was my first computer. Got it for Christmas, and downhill ever since then. And a couple weeks ago now, I don't know, you shared a photo on LinkedIn of Byte magazine, and I asked you, I'm like, is that the one that had the games in it? And you're like, no, that was a different one. So I went and I looked, and it was it Compute Gazette or something like that had more games and stuff. I think Byte was more like utilities, right?
Yeah, well, so there's that, but there's also like, I have a little, this is an old, even older thing. This is a 1980 Microcomputing magazine. So Microcomputing magazine, like
look at 1980. That bus, man, that's fantastic.
Hell yeah! But like, it would have program listings on it. Like you don't see it here well, but like there's a program listing here of something. And the magazines would come with these things. Like that was relatively common. Yeah. Maybe not necessarily games. This is a more of a serious type of computer magazine. Yeah. But like all of these things are program listings, and like this is a matrix sorting algorithm, I guess you can write in BASIC on a Commodore 64 or an IBM PC that supports QBASIC or something, whatever it was back then. But it's fascinating looking into these things because, you know, computing back then, and this is me putting my old man hat on, was a lot more of a hobby than a job is today, right? Like today we kind of like look at computers like, ugh. This thing again, right?
We're so spoiled now.
Yeah. Right? Take it for granted.
Take it for granted. And that's why I kind of have my little pink glasses on about the old age of computing, because everything seemed so simple back then. You know, people did it out of love. Of course it wasn't. It's not true, right? Like there was a lot of people hated it, but I feel like it's lost a little bit of its charm. And I think it's just I think the enthusiasm towards computing is not the same today as it was back then.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to explain that. So
yeah, I agree. I'm going to ask you, or I'm going to tell you one more thing about vintage computing. Mm-hmm. And then I think we'll fast forward like 40 years. Like I said, I grew up on a Commodore 64 and my mom was a typist when we were growing up. I did have a tape drive. That was the first thing that came with my Commodore 64. And I meant to ask my mom before this, and I got busy. I remember her sitting at the Commodore 64 typing, and I'm pretty sure it was assembly. There was some application we had that would like basically air check each line, and she would sit there probably for way longer than my very young brain at that time really realized how much work it was. She would type games. Maybe it was the Compute Gazette or whatever that was called. Mm-hmm. She would type games, save them to tape for my cousin and I. And she probably worked at that for hours and hours. And I meant to ask her about it because I bet you she would remember how much time she spent doing that for us. But yeah, back then it was different than it is now, right? It's seriously different.
It took so much time especially computer games on the Commodore 64. Like, you could do them in assembly. You usually needed an assembler to do that. So probably you would make a lot better and more official looking games than in BASIC. BASIC was kind of the basic thing people used for it. I have a friend who's older than me, and he had a Commodore 64 growing up, like in the early 90s. However, his family would like prevent him from using the computer throughout the day, only during the evening for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
So for him to optimize for time, basically what would happen is his family would take the TV cable, like just disconnect it from the TV, and you couldn't use it, right?
Yeah.
However, you can still turn on the Commodore. So what he would do is he would blindly type in games.
No.
Just like take a listing and blindly type in games, hoping for the best. And then by the time evening rolls around, he can just plug in the Commodore into the TV, check for errors, fix the errors, and play the games.
That is dedication. It's solid.
Dedication, right? Like, you don't do that anymore.
No.
But it is fascinating. Like, I actually spent a lot of time writing Commodore 64 or 6502 assembly. And in all honesty, assembly languages for these old CPUs, like the Z80 or the 6502, were dead simple. Like, you could fit everything you needed to know about programming in the assembly, you could fit in like a little booklet of 5 pages, right? All the things it has. However, being creative with the limitations was the challenge. And that's why a lot of people kind of honed their craft on assembly. Even relatively recently, when I say relatively recently, I mean the year 2000, a gentleman called Chris Sawyer, yes, made Roller Coaster Tycoon. You know the game Roller Coaster Tycoon?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
100% written in assembly. 100% written in assembly. It is insane.
Oh, yeah.
That's why the game is so optimized, so great, because it was 100% written in assembly. X86 assembly, fantastic.
That's awesome.
I love that craft. So.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, I could talk vintage computing. Like, we could just spend the next couple hours as much as I want to do that, I think we should also fast forward just a wee bit and talk a little bit about kind of how we're all spending our time now, which is AI, right? So I know, Travers, you have a bunch of questions, so I'll let you kick off this section. And why don't we talk about AI and how it's affecting what we're doing nowadays?
Okay, yeah. So I did have I went through your blog posts and your Git repos, Darko, and I have a couple of questions about. Notice a theme I wanted to ask you about where you use AI, where you draw the line between where not to delegate to an agent in your projects and what your kind of workflow looks like at the moment.
Well, so, okay. When AI first started a long time ago in the year of 2025, I was still very apprehensive of using agents to actually build the software I use because I felt they just weren't good enough. And I felt like I couldn't put them in control to do big enough tasks. So it felt very complex for me to just kind of delegate software to them because it usually ended up with slop. Now, late 2025, in 2026, the models became way much better. The harnesses became better, and I started using it more and more. So, what you will see me is I will delegate most of my coding to agents, but I do make a couple of important choices. I choose languages that I feel are very good to be coded with LLMs. So for all the Python fans out there, it's not Python, and it's not even JavaScript. I'm a Rust guy. So, and I know it's a whole meme, Rust, but here's the thing about Rust. Rust is a very, very peculiar language and how you should write it and how what's good and what's not. So its compiler, its borrow checker are very anal about how you use it. So I catch a lot of my issues early on during compilation, during checks, before it even gets into a proper binary. So I found the usage of a language like Rust or maybe even Java. I don't know Java enough to be able to say that, but a language like Rust feels incredibly safe to write with LLMs. I don't read all of my code. That would be preposterous because sometimes that's a lot of code. But I'm of an opinion that you can delegate a lot of the stuff to an LLM to just do it well and not care. But there are certain elements of your application, especially when it comes to security, especially when it comes to data sovereignty, to data privacy, where you have to be sure that the things it has created are actually the things you want. And there's no like, here's 20% of it should be red, or right? It depends on the project, depends what you're building. Right? If I'm building a little stupid application I'm gonna do some data entry at home for how I feel, sure, nobody cares, right? It's fine. Even if it's the worst application in the world, it's only me. I don't care about it. But if I'm building something for a production system, if I'm building something that's gonna expose me or my network or my data to the internet, I pay extra attention to those things through the use of, you know, tests or spec-driven development, or just me reading the code. It's a balance I have to find, project dependent, right? So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I feel like the code that has potential legal ramifications is a good line to draw there.
Well, yeah, exactly. If something can get you arrested, right, or landed in jail, you actually want to make sure that that's not, because Brett, you're an IBM guy. IBM wrote a long time ago, machine cannot ever be held accountable for the mistakes it makes, right?
Yeah.
So I think that remains the same today. A machine cannot ever, an LLM cannot ever be held accountable for your mistakes.
Yeah.
It's always the human that has made the decision. So it's your decision not to look at the code. Fine, but then you made that decision. So it's important we make the decisions. I do want to stress a problem that I've observed with myself, and this could be just me, but I have a feeling it's not just me. With the abundance of LLMs and just them having the ability to just do things, I don't pay as much as attention as I would need to. Right? I am like, oh, I'm just going to quickly do this and just walk away. And then I have nothing thinking about it. I don't know. I come back to it. I'm like, oh, what is this? Accept, right? So I think one of the challenges here that we need to face as a developer community is that we need to have a little bit more attention ourselves. The whole LLM transformer model revolution came from a paper called Attention is All You Need. And I think it's not a joke. That's the name of the paper.
The irony.
Yeah.
The irony, right? And we've lost so much attention right now. I need to legitimately kind of lock myself into a look at the editor and just let it do its thing, because as it's generating code, I start doing other things. I start not paying attention. I start like, and that's the thing I need to work on myself to make sure that I do it, especially for important things, because otherwise, well, I lose attention and I don't know what ends up happening. I've scrapped so many commits or pull requests to my things because I don't know, is this good or not? I have no idea. I've completely failed to pay attention.
Yeah.
And well, yeah.
It's not just you.
This is something we've talked about like episode after episode. Honestly,
every week we talk about this exact thing, right? Travers, like one of the things we do, Darko, when we don't have people on is we kind of break the show into three segments. We talk about AWS news that we think is interesting from the week before. We talk about AI news that we think is interesting from the week before. And I say to Travers every week, my favorite part of the show is actually the middle segment where Travers and I talk a little bit about the personal projects. Because Travers is going to roll his eyes when he said this. Like, I really think we're kind of in the era of personalized software, to your comment, right? Yes. Like, I'm not building a banking system, but I'm building something that I use every day in my own personal workflow that helps me do something that was monotonous or painful, therefore I didn't do it kind of thing. And that software is good for me. And I was just talking to somebody today, and we were kind of talking about the same thing, about all the different tools and solutions that he's been building. Every week Travers and I talk, I'll be like, I'm working on this. And Travers starts laughing a little bit. He's like, so am I. Because we've all got our own sort of approach or thought patterns on the way we would like to work with tools. And to your point, both Travers and I think it might have just been last week, Travers, we both said we kind of had to push away from our desks a little bit and, you know, go touch some grass and stuff, because it's really easy. Like, I'm looking at my herder here, and it's got 8 spaces open on it. That's not good, right? To your point, like, I'm giving it a little fragment of my attention, and then later I come back and I'm like, what was I like, why did I even think that? Because I don't think it's a good idea now.
That is the problem, right? That is the thing. And I think I've heard, like, the social milieu say, talk about, oh, you know, we've solved, you know, coding. Here's the thing. I think code generation has been solved for most part, right? I think code being generated is fine. We haven't solved software engineering, right? Because that is the thing that still exists. Even if you have a tool that generates your code, you still need to be a software engineer. You still need to be able to build it and focus on it, because otherwise it's slop. It's just pure slop. And I actually sometimes spend way more time, especially when somebody gives me like a thing to build and I have to quickly build a demo, I actually spend extra time so I don't embarrass myself, like, by showing bad code. Like, what is this? Like, this is horrible.
Yeah.
So still applying the best of the software engineering principles, still being a software developer. And I do fear that some people conflate code generation with software development. They're not the same thing. They're
different,
right?
Yeah.
Producing good code was never the critical element of software engineering. Yes, code was a big part of what you make, but code was also a big blocker in a sense. Like, code was the thing that would stop you from making software. Being a good software engineer doesn't mean you can write code really well. It probably is the same thing, but it's not necessarily. You can be a bad software engineer even if you can write good code.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So I think I can need this thing. And to your point about personal software, I think going back to old days of computing, people used to build just tools and applications and helper scripts and whatever for whatever they're building, because it was so much simpler to do. And then software became complex, and we just kind of, you know, I can't build this anymore. I'm just going to buy something off the shelf. And it was mostly good.
Yeah.
But now people start making bespoke things. I like that. I do a lot of bespoke software as well.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, me too. I think, you know, one of the things, and I'd like to hear both your opinions on this. It's kind of, from my perspective, it's for me, it's brought back a little bit of the joy of computing again, in the sense that if I have an idea, it's probably been bouncing around in my head for a long time, and I'm busy doing other things, or maybe I don't think I could actually build it. And now you're able to take those ideas. And I know people will say, like, oh, but yeah, if you can't understand every single line of code, then, you know, it's slop or whatever. But I just think it's brought a lot of joy back to computing for people, for building those little tools that they've thought in their heads for a long time, but they just weren't sure how to start or if they could do it. I think it's fantastic.
I agree. I 100% agree. And I think that I was never a proper software developer. So my software development was, skill was relatively limited, and I could build stuff, and I can, you know, Stack Overflow stuff through it, and it was fine. Like, I could get through it, right?
Yeah.
It took a lot more effort, and I would just kind of give up after a while. So with this, it brought me that ability to build things. Again, I have to be still not let it just kind of do stuff, because I still want it to be good, or maybe not. I don't care. But yes, it definitely did open up this door of me being able to build stuff. At the same time, I build a lot of stupid stuff now.
Yeah.
So some of it should not exist. Like, I'm going to build my own curl. Sure, bro. Like,
why not?
Why not? Right, yeah.
I don't have anything else to do. That's awesome.
Exactly. It's hard. The bottleneck's gone, right? Like,
sorry, Travers, say that again.
I just said the bottleneck is gone, right? Like, you can do whatever you can think of, you can put your mind to at this point.
Yeah. You know, one of the things, Darko, that I've been trying to do around that sort of making sure you understand what's happening and stuff is I do believe it's making me a better reader, because it's one of the things that I've really I've really sort of forced myself to do. I know sometimes these models are wordy. Like Travers and I are joking about, I think it was GLM 5.2 the other day. Opus 5 is quite wordy now. But just reading through its own logic and being able to call BS on that stuff and say, are you absolutely sure that that's the right way to do it? Forcing yourself to read that, I think, does a couple things. For me, it helps me learn because I'm it's maybe spitting out a little bit of code and I can look at it, I can ask questions, but it also makes me slow down a little bit. Like, I don't, just because I can generate 50,000 lines of code in an afternoon probably doesn't mean I should. Right. So reading is still a really important skill. And I've really forced myself to slow down and read that output. And sometimes I regret that decision, but I think it serves people well, I think, to do that.
This is my problem. Like, this is where my attention lags. Sometimes it starts spitting out stuff. I'm like, yeah, just go for it. Yeah. I definitely should pump the brakes and like, okay. So my trick to this is that I use coding assistants and a note-taking system. So like, I use Obsidian as notes, whatever, Markdown files.
Yeah.
And anytime I'm building stuff, my agent writes extensive notes what we're building.
Yeah.
So if I feel like I am skipping out, I just go back to my note and I read it and I'm like, that's not right. Or specs, right? Like when I build with Kiro, specs are my jam because I can spend an extra 30 minutes to plan out my software. And then once I'm happy with it, I just let it rip because that helps me. Okay, I now understand what it's going to build. From a software engineer perspective, this makes a lot of sense. These are the decisions I would make. And then it just produces code, right? And the code is good or bad, whatever. But
yeah.
But I think those things, and this is where me sitting in front of like multiple monitors is a problem because I put it on one screen and I keep doing something else. Or like in your case, like a terminal multiplexer, I'm just like 14 tabs in and I forget about it, right?
Yeah.
So my most productive coding sessions, building sessions with Kiro, where I would go to a coffee shop. I would just go to a coffee shop with my laptop and I could just do that. And I'm just sitting there. I can't be distracted. And I'm just like, okay, I'm just going to just do this. And I'm looking at it. And because I just give it more attention and you succeed so much more. It's fascinating. So
yeah.
I big fan.
Distraction is still a problem, right?
It is. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if I have ADHD, but oh my God, it's so bad. I definitely need to focus.
I sometimes wonder if these tools are maybe causing a little bit of distraction issues in people. Just your attention span is so short now because you're jumping between multiple tabs, multiple sessions. It's just easy to do, so you do it.
Well, again, putting my old man hat on, back in the old days, when you used to like program something like, so here I have a box ready. This, my friends, is Fortran 80.
Fortran.
Oh my.
But for the Osborne computer. Sure. Why not?
Right? Okay.
And everything you need to know about programming Fortran 80 for the Osborne computer, which is a portable computer, by the way, is here. That's the whole thing. Like everything, every bit of this language is here. And you would basically just sit and look at this reference manual and just like spend effort and focus on it. You can't do anything else besides this. And this gave me sometimes so much focus, right? Like just kind of working off a single sheet of paper with all the knowledge there helps me definitely focus a lot more. Again, we don't do that anymore. You probably shouldn't do that anymore. But it is humbling being not having access to information, because now we have access to all the information in the world and you can just kind of ask stupid questions and hopefully get the answer. But then you kind of had to infer the answer based off of this potentially badly written manual. And you're like, this is all I have to go for, right? So it's fascinating. The latest version.
Hopefully it's the latest version. Yeah,
sure. Right? Otherwise you have to send in, there's a little sheet in the back And yeah. I think it's called an update sheet where you basically mail them a little envelope with requesting the latest version. You put in $5 or whatever you put in, and they send you the latest version of the software. So yeah,
talk about good old days, right? Snail mail, where you actually put something in the mailbox, it disappeared, and 3 weeks later you got something back. And when you were younger, like every day you went to the mailbox, even though your mom's like, dude, you just put that in the mail yesterday. That's not how it works. You know, I'm going to go check anyways, just in case, right? Maybe it worked out in my favor, just in case. That's fantastic.
There's almost something about these systems being so limited, right? Like being so restricted in what you can do resource wise that gets you the benefits of more focus and more creativity. I wonder.
Yeah. It gives you more time to think about it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I do encourage people to try to play around with things that are completely impractical. So one of the most fun things to, I use fun in a very quote, it's fun for me. Okay. One of the most fun things to do is learn to program in assembly for the Atari 2600, right? The video game console.
I'm wearing my Atari shirt.
There you go. So hear me out. The 2600 is using a 6502 CPU, actually a 6507, which was a even more limited version of the CPU. It had less address line. Doesn't matter. However, it's the computer is in that console is so bare bones. It is so limited that everything has to be done manually. And you get these creative ways to do things. So for example, on a modern computer, and by modern, I mean a Commodore 64, you can tell it to draw a pixel on X, whatever, and Y, whatever. You give it coordinates, it draws a pixel.
Okay.
On an Atari 2600, that doesn't exist. So the Atari 2600, the way you draw pixels on the screen is by counting the beams. So on old television screens, the beam would be drawn from the top to the bottom, like in a zigzag pattern, 60 times a second, right? And there's like 520 lines like this, right? Exactly. There's like 500 lines from the top to the bottom, whatever, right? Depending on the standard. So the way you would draw a box, a pixel on like X5 and Y10, you count 10 lines from the top of the screen. There's a counter in there. You basically count how many times the beam goes across. Once it reaches 10, you run the correct line. And then between the edge of the screen and the point 5 on the screen, you can't tell it to just draw there. You have to wait a certain amount of CPU cycles and then draw, because you know that there's like each line takes like 170 CPU cycles, and then you kind of calculate to draw on this side, you need to wait for 7 CPU cycles. So it's incredibly manual, but it is fantastic. Like it's like the whole language fits on 3 pages of paper. You can learn the entire language syntax in an afternoon, but it's so fun to explore, fun to do things like that, because it forces you to think about how these things should be done.
That's awesome.
It's a little thing I do enjoy doing.
The only thing I remember about my Atari days are how many joysticks I went through, because we got summer games, I think it was, summer games, and you had to held the joystick, and like for all the sprinting games and stuff, you had to like go back and forth. Yeah, there you go. And you know, you'd go to play one day, it just wouldn't work anymore because you like just destroyed that thing playing summer games and sprinting in races with your friends or whatever. Fantastic computer.
I'm wondering, do I have a summer games cartridge here? Because I don't have that cartridge somewhere. I'm like, I had it. Dude. Oh my God. I had it somewhere here.
Me and my buddy Terry, like we were so obsessed with that game. I bet you it's been, oh man, I don't want to do the math because that'll just tell you all how old I am. You can probably tell from some of the color in my beard, but I bet you if I bumped into Terry on the street, we would talk about summer games because we spent so much time playing that stupid game and then having to save our cash to go buy new joysticks because we just wrecked them. Oh, man. Great
joystick
stuff.
Joystick destroyer game. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Great game.
last bit of trivia. How much RAM does an Atari 2600 have? It came out in 1977, around the same time the Commodore 64 came out. So 64K on the Commodore 64, 4 kilobytes on the, I don't know, the Apple II and whatnot. So, sorry, the okay. VIC-20 and Apple II has a 64 kilobytes. How much RAM does an Atari 2600 have?
I wouldn't even have a clue. It's probably insanely low, right?
Like 8 kilobyte, or is it bytes? Is it under? Is it under 1,000 bytes?
It's bytes.
You oh yeah, it looks like a
how much RAM it has. So it has 128 bytes of RAM. So that's the only that's as much RAM as you can work it. That's a there's ways on the cartridge to put some stuff that it's not as simple as that. But the machine itself, 128 bytes. It has no ROM. There's nothing. The only ROM that exists is on the cartridge itself. So it's
that's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, so kind of working off your like, hey, this is how you should get started. Go figure out, you know, how to write assembly on the Atari 2600. I hope somebody actually goes and does that and then tells us they did it, because that would be yeah. awesome. My follow-up question to that then is let's take that same idea and put it in the sort of the current era with AI. Like, I know we're really early days, right? Like you said earlier mm-hmm. on, 2025, you're a little reluctant. Travers and I talk about this. Like, it changed for me sort of very early 2026. I think it was the same. 2025, mm-hmm. I was like, I don't know about this yeah. stuff, right? It's a little sketchy. And then it changed in 2026. So we're really early days, right? It's what, only July. So we're 6 months in, I think, when people really start thinking about this thing. If you were talking to somebody and they're like, you know, I've been skeptical till now, but maybe I should try this out. Like, what would you suggest that they try, like, to get started? Is it just pick an old project that they've had bouncing around their head, revive that old domain name that they bought and put something on it? Like, what would you suggest if somebody's just not overwhelmed and not sure where to actually start?
I think it depends on the level of experience this person has. Like, if this is an old fart software developer, like that like really knows their skills, like it will take a little bit of a harder, bigger thing to impress them. I think there's two ways to impress people. One way is to actually tell it to build a project you had on your mind on for a long, long time. I just like, build me that. I don't care. And you will be probably impressed how well it does it. It probably won't be perfect, but like, oh my God, it's 95% there. And that's what's probably going to be impressive. Or you're going to be impressed by the fact that you take an existing code base that you've built, that you've invested effort and time into it, that you understand dearly, and you have it go at it, right? You have it add a feature to it, and you will actually understand exactly what it's doing, and it's going to feel good. I think one of my biggest reluctances in the beginning is that I felt the lack of control with them, right? I was like, I don't know what's going on. I have no idea what is happening. So picking a project that you know dearly is something that will not give you this feeling of like, oh my God, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't like this. I still going to do it myself. So, and also picking a project or a language or a framework that you know intimately is also going to make it better, because I exactly know what kind of a mistake an LLM can make of Rust, right? I fully know that. Then I can easily just look at its output and what it's doing them, say, oh, that's not how you should be doing stuff, right? So yeah, I think that is the thing that I would say, tell people, is just taking the thing you already know very well, add a feature to it, and look at it go.
Yeah.
So it will make you feel that you're in control, and you will be in control, yeah. But it will also show you the benefit of it kind of fixing stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's just really solid advice, right? Like, I've got myself into trouble before where I'm like, I'm just going to have it write TypeScript because that's what the LLM decided it should write. I don't know TypeScript. Sure. Like, I could look at it and go, well, the extension mm-hmm. is TS, so I know that's TypeScript, but that's it.
Sure.
And you know, without the domain expertise, you can get yourself in a lot of trouble. Again, like we were talking about earlier on, right? Like, what is this thing actually doing? Can you explain what it's doing? Not that you need to read every line of code, but if somebody asked you to walk them through it, would you be able to do that? So I love that advice. So sort of staying focused on somewhere where you have some domain expertise, take away a lot of the scariness and make it a little easier transition, I think, to get started.
Exactly. Cool. Exactly. Yeah. And a person who knows the domain is going to be so much more elevated with this tool, right? Like, and that's what I want to make sure that people understand. this is a tool. It's a thing that makes you better, right? Like, again, I treat it as NeoVim. Like, I think NeoVim makes me an amazing software developer because it's a tool that makes me do stuff faster. This is the same thing. It's just a tool that makes you do stuff faster. If you misuse the tool, sure, bro, it's your fault, right? Like, you have to be the one to use this thing correctly. So yeah. You can always drive a car into the wall if you want, but then you're gonna blame the car for it,
yeah,
right?
That's true.
So it's good. One thing I always keep telling, especially this is the biggest challenge with the LLMs these days, right? I think there's a big gap between us old farts, us people who are building stuff and already are embedded in the industry and we can just kind of do things, versus people who are coming into the industry, right? They've been, over the last 4 or 5 years, they've been in colleges and schools and they've been learning stuff and they feel like this thing has just like a roll over them, right? All of their skills are worthless these days, right? And I get that feeling, and that's a valid feeling people have. However, I do think that this is a perfect opportunity for people to just learn everything they wanted to learn. Because you have this little magical box that answers all the questions and can literally saturate your curiosity as much as you want.
Yeah.
And for the first good year and a half since LLMs came out, and back in 2023 or 2024, I've exclusively used it to learn stuff. Like, I've been like, okay, don't write any of my code. I think Claude Coding existed back then. I don't know if you know, Brett, but if you remember, but on my live streams, I used to build a tool in Rust called Bedrust.
Yes.
And it was a little command. Yeah. So I like to say that Claude Code stole it because they basically build the same tool that looks the same way. I'm like, sure. You can see it on my GitHub if you want it. Yeah. But I built this tool by hand. But as I built it, it started being more and more useful. So I actually used it on the side to help me build it further because it taught me Rust. It teach me how to do things. So I used to basically, okay, teach me how to do, I don't know, parallelism in Rust. And it would just, okay, let's do this. And it would give me like little challenges for me to do daily. And I think it's an excellent tool as long as you give it enough attention to learn whatever you want to learn. Like, you want to be a game developer, excellent. Go and spend some cycles to learn what is game development and how it works, what are the tools, what are those things, and then use that tool to do that, but you will still know a lot more than just build me a game, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, you've basically got a tireless tutor there, and anything you throw at it, it can tell you a little bit about it. Now, should you trust everything it says to you? You probably should do some additional reading, you could argue that that's been the way it always has been. Like, should you trust everything that Google spit out at you? Probably not. Should you trust everything that you ever read on Stack Overflow? Probably not. But at least it's pointing you in a direction, and then you go fill in the blanks and decide, okay, this is what makes sense for me, and this part of it here is just not applicable, or that was just wrong, right? And I'll just ignore that part and move on.
Should you trust us? Probably not, but yeah. So
no, you can trust the three of us. And that, after that, you're on your own.
Maybe, I don't know.
Maybe. That's fantastic. Travers, do you have anything that you wanted to ask?
Let me think here. I mean, you mentioned NeoVim. What do you have any other favorite tools that you like to use in your day to day, or what's your stack look like?
I mean, I'm a Linux through and through user, right? So I'm a person who lives and breathes on Linux. I use a Mac for work because it's work, but for my normal day to day stuff, it's Linux. So it's usually a combination of a terminal, a window manager, Tmux, like a terminal multiplex. I haven't tried Herder. I need to try Herder. I heard
that's pretty
good things about it. I see people talk about it.
Yeah.
And that was my thing. Like, it's just NeoVim on one side, a terminal on the other side, be that in a terminal multiplexer or a window manager, and it was just me and the terminal. So I'm one of those weird people that I love to use the IBM little nub on the keyboard for mouse navigation.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So I just use that. Fantastic. So I'm a ThinkPad user, and but I would, if I could exclusively exist in the command line, I would probably do that. But sometimes I can't. So
yeah, sure. Yeah. I'm kind of the same. Yeah, sometimes you need an IDE here or there, right? You have no choice.
I haven't used an IDE in a long time.
Yeah. Travers.
Yeah. I'm not shaming for.
Yeah, Travers and I talk about this every week. Like, there seems to be more and more terminal tools coming out. And you know, there was a comment that we found, it was ages ago, feels ages ago now, like the guy, it was a bit of a hot take, but it was something along the lines of like, if you're using an IDE, you're probably falling behind. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but I don't know.
Shout out to the folks from JetBrains. Like, they make an excellent IDE, right? And like, I think if you're part of the Java ecosystem or even C++, I mean, JetBrains is the place you will use it. Like, I think it's a bad take to say IDEs don't have a space. Yeah. I think IDEs are evolving with stuff, but a lot of the stuff people are kind of building is built by agents without an IDE, which is sure fine. Yeah. Great, but I also do think IDEs have a big place in this. So don't give up on IDEs. I still, again, even with LLMs writing all my code, I have NeoVim on the side and just like looking at the code through NeoVim. Yeah. I don't necessarily type it in, but it's still there. I think it's fine. But I haven't personally used an IDE in a long time. I actually never got on the VS Code bandwagon.
You missed that one.
Blew up. Never. I'm like, never. I would just open up VS Code, enable Vim shortcuts, and I'm like, I'm just going to use Vim, sure. I mean, like, I legit didn't need it, so. But hey.
I kind of skipped over that, too. Remember, Travers, it was PyCharm, right? Always PyCharm was PyCharm. The ID. You're right. They make great tools for that kind of stuff. Fantastic stuff.
JetBrains
right?
is fantastic. Oh, fantastic. Yeah. I think.
we're coming to the top of the hour, and we haven't talked about Kiro. And I think we need to talk about Kiro a little bit. You know, like, as much as we were just saying about IDEs, I have Kiro on my laptop here. I use it for reading a ton of Markdown all the time. Like, it's just my default editor for that. Why don't, like, for somebody that's maybe IDE reluctant or has been using other IDEs for a while, like what would you say to them about Kiro? Like, what makes Kiro maybe different than some of the other IDEs they've run into?
Well, here's the thing. Kiro is not necessarily exclusively an IDE, right? That's the first flavor of Kiro we launched. It's Kiro, the Kiro IDE. It's a fork of open source code. It's VS Code, but it has a bunch of bells and whistles that are Kiro related, from you know, Spectrum development to hooks and steering files and whatnot. But I would say that Kiro is one of those things that lives across multiple surfaces. So I'm actually going to pop in a screen share if that's a thing I can do here.
Yeah,
so,
I don't know. You're going to be the first person to try it. Let's see what happens.
I think I know. Look at that. Boom. I have a screen share, so I'm not sure if you can bring it up. So let's see. Brett, do your magic.
Oh boy. No pressure. Travers, you might disappear for a second. Hold on. Let's see what happens.
Oh no. Well,
we'll still hear you, I think. Fine. Okay.
There you go. Okay.
Kind of.
Sure, I guess.
Kind of.
Well, in any case, what I wanted to say is that I'll stop sharing because I'd rather look at Travers.
We'll bring Travers back.
Kiro.
Hold on. Where's Travers now?
So what I'm saying, trying to say is that.
Travers, I want to bring Travers back to life. Hold on. Add. Oh man.
I ruined it.
You're showing me. You're teaching me the limitation. There he is. We're teaching me the limitations of our stream. Did it dump you in the green room or something?
He had muted me and it put me in like a timeout.
Okay, so Darko just gave us a task that we have to figure out. Or when I say we, I mean me. How the hell to do screen shares in this tool? Because everybody up until this point, it's just Travers and I mug. That's it.
Yeah, there you go. But Kiro exists beyond just the IDE, right? It exists in the command line tool, which is kind of my favorite utility. Just the Kiro CLI is just fantastic. I have it running on my laptop, and I have a virtual machine in my rack, and it's a thing I do love. So the IDE, the CLI, there is also Kiro Web, which is you go to app.kiro.dev, and you have a web interface of Kiro. Now, the web interface of Kiro is not an IDE. It's a thing where you point it at a repo, you tell it, please do this. It does this, makes a pull request, and that's it. Fantastic, right?
Oh wow!
On top of that, I have also this. There's the Kiro Mobile as well, which is a phone version of Kiro, which is basically just a little front end for the Kiro Web. But in essence, you can use Kiro from your phone and basically tell it to do the same things as Kiro Web would do. You ask it to do a thing, it goes ahead, does that thing, makes a pull request. And you're ready to go. So Cure exists on multiple platforms, and it's kind of helps you as a developer to just kind of do stuff. The thing about Kiro that makes it stand out is definitely the heavy approach to not just speed, but what's the word? Correctness is the word. So from the use of spec-driven development, so instead of you just YOLOing through it building something, it actually creates a proper spec, a requirements doc, a design doc, and a list of tasks it needs to execute, to using property-based testing for ensuring that each property in your requirements doc is actually met, to use something called neurosymbolic AI. Basically, it does a bunch of additional math and tests to ensure that the correctness of your application is right. Sometimes even the requirements doc is not correct. There's maybe conflicting information in the requirements doc. There may be not vague requirements. And so it uses a bunch of these additional steps to make sure that it's actually correct and it produces the thing. So even before the first byte of code is written, it actually checks those things for you. So you don't have to worry about it too much. So that's Kiro in a nutshell. It's a product by AWS, right? There's a subscription thing and whatnot. So it is an amazing little tool. Last week, 2 weeks ago, was the 1 year anniversary of Kiro. So
yeah, I saw a few people post it on LinkedIn, happy birthday kind of thing. Yeah, I think I do need to give it a little more time. I used it at the very beginning when it was kind of like, I don't know if it was called beta or whatever, but you could, if you were lucky enough to kind of request access quickly, you got access. And if you didn't get on that list, you had to wait a little while. So I poked around, and the spec driven stuff is really neat. You know, Travers and I talk a lot about vibe coding versus sort of spec. I don't know if Travers, I don't think we really call it spec driven, but much more like giving it the proper thought and laying out what you want to do planning, rather than just kind of, just hoping for the best. Right. So definitely have to go back and give it another whirl. But I said to you before we started, like, I'd be dead without the CLI. Kiro CLI, the autocomplete for AWS CLI commands, it's the best thing that's ever happened.
It's great. One of the things in the Kiro CLI, one of the fascinating things that I do, and I built something, and I'm going to share it when I'm ready. But so Kiro CLI supports ACP, or the Agent Control Protocol. That means you can build your own whatever to use the Kiro's harness. So one of the things that I mentioned in the beginning, I have an old dumb terminal there, and I want to hook up that dumb terminal to a modern system. And you can do that through a serial connection. That's not an amazing thing. However, once you start showing some modern terminal graphics or lines or colors, it freaks out. Like, it doesn't like those things. It hasn't been built for that. So I've built my own shell that's a pure Kiro shell based off ACP. So it's a tool built in Rust that uses the ACP to just interact with Kiro through the ACP on a dumb shell. So hopefully in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be able to show Kiro running on an old terminal. So
that's very cool.
And it's great. Kiro CLI, again, it has a bunch of features. Like, you can actually run it in headless mode. You can basically pass it on an API key. So if you have a CI/CD pipeline to run Kiro, you can run Kiro within a CI/CD pipeline. Fantastic.
Definitely. I think it's changed, obviously, in true AWS fashion. It's changed dramatically over its very short lifespan, right? Like, a lot of features in there that you really have to spend the time with and figure out and see how you can use them in your own workflow.
I agree. But definitely check out app.kiro.dev. If you have a Kiro account, app.kiro.dev, hook it up to GitHub or GitLab. Anytime you want to do a little, I want to update all my packages in my thing, it just does it. Fantastic.
Okay. I'm going to try that because I'm thinking of a project right now that probably would make sense to tie it to it and just see how it works. What's the worst that could happen?
Well, let me know. I'll get you some credits if you need.
There you go. Hey, awesome. Hey, perfect. Travers, when do you want to come back? We'll have you on next month too. Just the standing guest now. Travers, anything else on your Q&A list there as we push past the hour here? Anything else?
I think that was the main things I wanted to get into. I think it's really interesting that you took the dumb terminal and then adapted a modern CLI tool with to work with modern protocols, right? Like, you would never have done that probably before the advent of this tech, right?
Modern command line applications are modern. Like, they're super heavy. Like, especially these things that use like TypeScript in the back, and Kiro uses TypeScript. It's like super complex, and there's like a bunch of rendering things that don't exist on like dumb terminals, because dumb terminals are just like text and nothing else. These modern had like color escape sequences and whatever kinds of shenanigans. So I had to strip all of that out and just hear ASCII and that's it. Nothing
that's,
else.
That's so fantastic. That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, I do. I will try that. The Kiro dev. I want you to try Herder because
I will try Herder.
I was a little reluctant. Like Travers and I were joking, like, oh, here's another terminal program, right? Like, how many of those do I need on my laptop now? And I installed it because somebody in a Discord channel was like, you should try this, and I did, and then I never used it. But over time, I've really actually. I think it's become pretty much my primary tool at this point. So I'd love to see what you think. Travers, are you using it more and more now? Or
yeah, here and there. I'm like 50-50 split between that and Tmux. It's kind of funny. It's like Darko and I have pretty much the exact same stack. It's just Tmux and NeoVim. It does the job.
I mean, I started with Screen a long time ago. So and then moved to Tmux and then I tried a couple of other things. But yeah, I will try Herder. One of the things I do like about my terminal multiplexer is their simplicity. So if Herder is too complex or too much on the eyes, I will probably
it's not use it. But we'll see. What do you think, Travers? Is it too much on the eyes? Like you being more of a Tmux guy, what do you think?
I think it's a pretty good grouping system for specific projects.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been using it for.
Yeah, that's what I like too. I'm coming from Ghosty. Ghosty was like my primary terminal. And then I tried CMUX for a while and I said to Travers, I don't like the sidebar. It's too heavy. Like it just doesn't work with the other part of it. And then Herder came along and it feels like kind of maybe between just Ghosty and CMUX, maybe a little lighter weight. So I don't know. Be interested to see what you think.
But Herder runs within a thermal, right? I'm running it within Ghosty.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah. I fire up Ghosty and then just run Herder. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. Well,
okay.
Thank you very much, Darko. We always end the show with a little recommendations section that I did not give you the heads up on. So you can participate or not.
Yes.
I'll leave that up to you. Travers and I, we have this little thing about just really crappy B movies that are so bad that you have to watch them. Doesn't necessarily need to be every recommendation every month is a movie recommendation. I think we only half joked one time. We'll just turn this podcast into a movie review podcast because we're movie files. Travers, can I ask you to get us started? Do you have any recommendations for the week?
So I watched American Ninja recently.
Yeah.
And it does exactly what it says on the tin. It's
it's good, is it?
If you like schlocky action, it's pretty good.
It's perfect. Good. Okay. That's fantastic. I am very quickly scrambling because I forget the name of this movie. I'm going to see if you can figure it out. Karen told me about it. It showed up in her feed somewhere. And it has Steve from that Stranger Things. Okay, remember the Steve character? He's in it, and it's like it's almost like a fungus is infecting people, and you either like infect somebody else or just blow up, and then basically spread the fungus to try to infect other people. You have to watch it. Like I didn't watch it right away. Karen actually came upstairs and she said, when you talk to Travers, you have to tell him to watch this movie. And then I watched the end with her. So I've got a job to do on the weekend to watch the beginning. Oh my God. It's got Liam Neeson in it. What's it called?
Cold Storage.
Put it on your voting list and let's see if you and your movie watching friends enjoy it, because
see if we can get it in.
I think it's worth a watch. I only watched like maybe the last 45 minutes of it because I was spending too much time working on side projects. So but definitely worth it. And then what else did I watch? I watched, did I tell you? Yeah, I told you about Night Watch already. Yeah, I think we talked about that one last week. I don't really have much else other than the end of that movie. Definitely worth a shot. Worth a watch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I recommend the book, I guess? I don't know.
Yeah, of course.
I Yeah, I was trying to think which B movie I watched. A stupid B movie. It's not even a B, I think it's a proper A movie, but like it's so bad. Like it was like those you watch like, oh god, it's great. It's like this, like you don't care much too much about it. It's a fun action watch, but it's like, oh my god, it's stupid. I can't remember the name. However, a book or a book series I actually want to recommend for especially for folks in the world of tech is called it's the book series of Bobbyverse.
Bobbyverse.
It was written by Dennis E. Taylor. Dennis E. Taylor is a software developer, and this is hard sci-fi. And it's, I think, series of eight books or six books, I think, right now. Fantastic. Oh, my God. The premise is guy uploaded his consciousness to AI, and he's in a probe, like a von Neumann probe. And fantastic. Oh, my God. There's six books. I read them twice.
Weird Legion, nice. Dear Bob.
Yeah, you've recommended this before, really, I think, Fred, actually.
I've read this series. You're spot on. So good. I did find, maybe was it book three that kind of...
There was one that's a little bit...
Just kind of... It picked up after that. But those... that first book, I could not put that thing down. It was so good.
Amazing.
Yeah, so good.
I love it. Definitely a recommendation for folks. So
there you go. Awesome. Well, thanks again, man, for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I was telling you to prepare yourself for the intro song. Prepare yourself for the outro. I think it may be better than the intro. I don't know. It's close. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see everybody next week. Thanks, Darko. Bye.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.
Software used to cost $1 million.